On a cold, overcast spring day in March 1977, in a small rural town in Ohio, Mary Gillespie opened her front door and started the trek to her mailbox. The Gillespie home on Brook Miller Road sat in isolation. Surrounded by farmland and trees, their closest neighbors were miles down the road. It was a remote area. To retrieve their mail, Mary would have had to have walked a few hundred feet to their mailbox, positioned just a few feet off of Brook Miller Road. The walk itself probably would have only taken less than 7 minutes. But on that cold March day, between the rain and the snow, it would have been enough time to just have been a kind of quiet reprieve for Mary to gather her thoughts, maybe just to catch her breath, a moment of peace. Mary, her husband Ron, and their daughter Tracy would get all kinds of mail. Bills, family letters, holiday cards, promotions, mail like every other family in the town of Circleville, Ohio. But on that day in 1977, what was waiting for Mary at the end of that long walk to the mailbox was different. It was a letter postmarked from Columbus, Ohio, with no return address. Written on a single sheet of paper in slanted, blocky handwriting was this:
"Stay away from Massey. Don't lie when asked about knowing him. I know where you live and have been observing your house and know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious. Everyone concerned has been notified, and everything will be over soon."
Standing alone in the early spring quiet by her mailbox on Brook Miller Road, one can only imagine the sudden unease Mary must have felt as those words sank in. On that rural road in the open, she wasn't alone with her thoughts. Someone was there with her. Letter in hand, turning away from the open road, she starts back to the shelter of her house, quickening her pace. This letter, the one she received in March 1977, is the first of over 40 anonymous letters sent and received over the span of a decade. Handwritten in that strange, blocky, uppercase lettering, this ongoing correspondence was mysterious, belittling, threatening, and would ultimately end with an attempt on Mary's life. Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. This episode, we arrive in the small town of Circleville, Ohio. Beginning in 1977, Mary Gillespie and other residents of Circleville, Ohio began to receive anonymous letters. And not just a few trickling in here or there, but thousands of letters that accused the citizens of the small town of being involved in some pretty terrible things: embezzlement, domestic violence, affairs, and even murder. Letter after letter, year after year, this anonymous author was hell-bent to expose every ugly little secret in Circleville. The writer was relentless, but the real scary thing was that a lot of these accusations contained some very particular and accurate personal information, exposing some of the most private details from people's lives. It was clear that this anonymous author knew their subject and knew them well. They could have been a friend, a neighbor, or maybe even family. The person putting that much venom into people's mailbox wasn't some stranger, and they were certainly not planning on stopping or even slowing down. This anonymous writer wasn't just content to turn over every rock in the private lives of Circleville citizens just to see what squirmed out. They wanted something. And in 1983, after a decade of mailing malice and threats, they would try and kill Mary Gillespie to get it. But who was the Circleville writer, and what were they trying to achieve? How could just one person possibly know so much about the private lives of the residents and keep it up for decades? And in 1990, when someone was finally arrested, did the police ultimately catch the right person? On this season of Whatever Remains, we untangle a decade's worth of police records, hundreds of pages of court transcripts from the trial of Paul Freshhauser, the man ultimately convicted of these crimes. We read the letters themselves, some of them not made public in years, and try and track their origins. We'll learn more about the lives of the people of Circleville that lived under this shadow for years, and how these letters wore at this community. And we'll talk to law enforcement officers and a private investigator who is still working to solve this ongoing mystery. But beyond the attempted murder of Mary Gillespie, there were other brutal, unsolved deaths that the Circleville letter writer appeared to know about. Were they in some way responsible, or were they trying to seek justice? We'll try to figure out who was behind the Circleville letters, the anonymous writer with a grudge to bear on one small town, and what could have been their reason for flooding Circleville with so much malice. Circleville, Ohio is a beautiful, peaceful small town, population a bit over 13,000. There's more than 80 cities in the state of Ohio that are larger. So in earnest, it really truly is a small town. But once a year, the town swells to over 400,000 people as they all swarm there for the Circleville Pumpkin Show, a three-day extravaganza celebrating that one orange gourd. But Circleville, Ohio is exceptional because it appears to be perfectly ordinary. Imagine a serene snow globe of a town, and that's Circleville. Now, if you know anything about small towns, or like me, if you grew up in one, Circleville may conjure up images of family and friends, the sense of connection to a community, holiday festivities, birthdays, school dances, parades, maybe all in all a bit bland, but comforting, secure times. But there's also an uneasy feeling with small towns, a vivid sense that it's too small and cloying, too perfect. It doesn't even really matter how fond these warm memories are. Something about that small town, even though it's so familiar, isn't inviting you to stay. You could even argue the opposite. There's something in that small town that isn't right. It's just not safe. Small towns tend to have big secrets, buried deep under those freshly mown lawns. This trope of something being not quite right in the small town is famous and hugely popular. David Lynch and Twin Peaks, Stephen King and Derry, even Harper Lee in To Kill a Mockingbird. This one simple idea of the small town gone bad is the basis for endless entertainment, and we love it. We crave digging up those dark little horrors. We want to know everything. That is, until we do. Start turning over those rocks and there is no telling what could crawl out. And like those stories we crave, something pretty disturbing happened in Circleville, starting small, flourishing over decades. It began quietly in 1977. The first set of letters would become the origin story, the groundwork for all the later events that happened in Circleville. 1977 was the town's first real exposure to this virus. The anonymous letters started to make their way into people's mailboxes on March 2, 1977, and they were not sent to Mary Gillespie. In fact, she wasn't even the subject of them. Surprisingly, the first letter was sent to Westfall High School to the attention of Gordon Massey. Gordon Massey was the school superintendent for Westfall and had a long career in Ohio school districts, first as a principal and then as a local school superintendent. School superintendent is a pretty big role, especially in a small town in the 70s. If a school is a corporation, then the superintendent is the CEO. They are responsible for all major events, good or bad, and for the image or the brand of that school. Much of what a superintendent's actual job is building support from other groups within a school. So they have to be very tight with the parents of the students, the community, and even the local government. And while the superintendent runs the school, the Board of Education is in charge of the superintendent for the district. Just like the board of a corporation, the Board of Education has oversight for that superintendent. A big responsibility of a superintendent is making recommendations about operations for that district. Things like staffing decisions for teachers, monetary investments, things like that. But maybe even more important, it's the superintendent's role to keep the board informed of events or happenings in that district that could have an impact on them, the school, the people themselves. And like a corporation, the board can fire a superintendent should they think they are not effective at doing their job. For a small town superintendent whose job it is to avoid issues and keep the peace in their district, receiving the first letter must have detonated like a bomb in Gordon Massey's hands. Written in a cramped small print alternating between upper and lower case, it alleges that Massey was sexually harassing the women's school bus drivers at Westfall High School.
Letter 1, mailed from Columbus, Ohio on March 2nd, 1977, addressed to Westfall High School. Attention, Superintendent Massey. No return address. Dear sir, according to my girlfriend, you have asked her to go out many times and have asked the other female bus drivers too. Due to your position and their jobs with you, you should not do this. This must stop at once for the good of the school and families. If they are not stopped, I will be forced to write to the school board, and I'd hate to do that. To prey on another man's girl is untouchable, especially when they're out trying to make a living. There is also talk of you dating a married woman and taking advantage of them. Do you need time and names again? Please think. I suggest you find yourself a pimple-faced whore and start up with her and leave my girls alone.
The letter writer is saying that he knows this is happening because Massey has asked out his girlfriend, but seems to believe that he needs to stop because it's not good for families or the school. These women are trying to make a living, and if Massey doesn't stop immediately, he'll do the one thing that every superintendent's job is to avoid. He'll go straight to the school board. But were the allegations in the letter true? And if they were, how did the letter writer know? Were they really the boyfriend of one of the public school drivers at Westfall? Maybe most importantly, what does the letter writer want? Then, just a mere 2 days later.
Address to Westfall High School. Attention, Board of Education. No return address. Dear School Board, this is to inform you that you have several dissatisfied female drivers due to their working relations with their boss. He dates a lot of the drivers. One, because she's afraid to because of her job and because of his position. He constantly asks several of them over and over. No one ever stops him. He will not take no for an answer from a couple of them. It even bothers some that he has not asked. They would like the chance to tell him where to go. Under these circumstances, they cannot be treated equally. He picks on the weaker ones constantly. This is a terrible working condition and must be stopped for the sake of the schools and the families involved. Again, you should investigate. He has dated several of them. Before long, we'll start repeating the rounds all over again, causing on some more hardships and others a low morale problem. Some have even considered a bargaining unit for job protection. He's a really nice guy on the outside, but please talk to your drivers independently for the full facts of how he is to work for. Please talk to them and treat the problem. Some are nervous and shouldn't be driving under additional pressure as this. After me writing this letter, I sure hope he does not upset my girl for his sake.
The letter is sent to the same address from Columbus, but this time attention to the Board of Education. The handwriting here is moving towards a script and is neater, more uniform, as if the writer needs to present themselves more respectfully to this audience. Sexual harassment should be reported and dealt with, full stop. And these accusations are serious. If you, your girlfriend, a loved one, is the target of this or witnessed it, if they have to work in it, then the anger is understood and warranted. The writer is calling out a systematic abuse that would not become part of our nation's discourse, well, till pretty much now. But if you are serious about bringing this wrongdoing to light, then why write Gordon Massey at all? Why warn him that this was coming? Why not contact the Board of Education directly? If the writer fears repercussion for making these accusations, then why make threats? The timing of when these two letters were sent begs the question about the writer's ultimate motivation. Clearly, 2 days between Gordon Massey's receiving the first letter and the school board receiving the second is not a lot of time for Massey to take any real recourse or action. He wouldn't have had time to formulate a plan, to reach out to the school board and warn them. He would have been in some level of just recoil. 2 days is just enough time for Gordon Massey to start to understand how bad of a predicament he was in. And the letter writer, whoever it was just getting started.
Letter 3, mailed from Columbus, Ohio on March 4th, 1977. Addressed to Westfall High School. Attention, Superintendent of Schools. No return address. Dear Superintendent, this is to inform you several of your bus drivers are working under pressure due to their boss constantly putting the moves on them. Some like it. The decent ones don't. Is he getting paid to run the women or run the bus lines? Again, some move behind him because they need the attention and are weak. Should this position be filled by someone capable of taking advantage of his job, school, and people that work for him? Is this the type of family man that we need in a position such as this, capable of using working women because of his advantages? One woman dates him because of her job. This is a terrible working relations, and something must be done about it. Most of the drivers know what is going on, constantly. You should talk to them, and also him, before something drastic happens. For he cares not if they are married or single. Could he be allowed to hound them constantly? I was informed at first by a close friend and refused to believe it. But she proved it through several other friends. I told them to take this matter to someone, but so far they have not. It's only a few, but they still should count, too. I can prove this, and will, if her school insists on it. I feel that at first he should be talked to, and the drivers also. I will find out through the grapevine if he has been put in line. I know of his affairs now, and can prove it. And will do so if he continues harassing drivers for dates, especially when they keep saying no and he constantly hounds them. I have met him, and he seems like a sincere man, so I would like to see this matter made right and forgotten. I can't stand the thought of him thinking about this. One of these drivers, or especially my girl, which I'm sure makes no difference to him. I am being informed of him daily, and can point out the last drivers he has been with. I shall prove it to you. Again, he needs talking to, so this matter can be forgotten. Give the drivers a break. Help them. Find out for yourself. Treat all equal. Friends of concerned drivers that are in fear. I have always been against school tax dollars bonuses because of their purpose and won't pay it unless correction and action has been taken.
Sent on the same day as the one to the school board, but to a superintendent in a different district. This letter is moving beyond concern. The writer wants the harassment stopped and for the bus drivers to be heard, but it's also alleging that some of these women don't mind being sexually harassed. Some even like it. Needless to say, that is not the case. There's also some menace to it that they will find out through the grapevine if Gordon Massey has been put in line. In these first three letters from the anonymous letter writer, there's no return address or identity of who the author is. The closest we come here is that they are mailed from Columbus, Ohio, Postal Hub 430. But there are definite signatures. The letter writer's beginnings aren't about Mary Gillespie, the woman who would soon become the writer's target. It starts with pushing to make sure that one man, Gordon Massey, would be very scared. To be sure that he knew that even though he was a supposed well-respected school superintendent with his picture in the paper, he wasn't in control. If what this letter writer was saying was true, his family, his job, his reputation was over, and he couldn't do anything to stop it. All Gordon Massey could do now is wait by his mailbox. Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. Our next episode, The Letters Keep Coming, and we introduce you to the story's other main players, in the town of Circleville, Ohio. So until our next episode, dear listeners, remember, what goes around comes around. Want to know what Whatever Remains is getting up to next? Follow us on Twitter at Whatever Remains or online at whateverremainspodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Your review helps others to find the show, and we love, love, love hearing from our listeners. So please, please reach out. Our intro music is by the fabulous group Rhoda. Our new closing song for Circleville is vocals and guitar by the rock god, Ed Grabanowski, produced by Rich Root. Excellent, excellent cover. Love it. The all-seeing eye, or our logo, is by the super talented Desdemona. This episode features the voice talents of Terrence Jenkins as the anonymous letter writer. Copyright 5 Orange Pips Production, all rights reserved.